again, and welcome to another episode of No Prize Podcast. I am your host, the Professor Bud Young, and with me, as always, from across the pond, is Johnny the Machine Hughes. How are you, Johnny?
I am very well. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm feeling much better. Back in the saddle here, and we got a nice full slate of books to talk about this week. What do you want to start with?
I think we should start with House of X 2, because that's the oldest of the books we're going to look at.
Sure. So we'll spend some time talking about the X books. Do you want to take it off the top here for House of X?
Yeah, sure. So House of X, as you by know by now, is written by Jonathan Hickman, art by Pepe Larraz, colors by Marte Gracia, letters by VCs Clayton Cowles. That's the tagline. I have to say that this book, cover to cover, was unputdownable. I absolutely love this whole idea of it. I started the book, I was kind of like, where's this going? What's going on? Yeah. And then about like a third of the way in, I was like, wow. And it just, one simple change to one character had such a huge impact. It was a stroke of genius, I thought. And then through that change, they get to try and set up all the X continuity together so that it kind of makes a modicum of sense.
Yeah.
Which I thought was inspired.
It's like a tether now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And you're kind of like, so they're not saying that what happened in the past didn't happen. And they're not saying it didn't happen in like an alternative universe. It's pretty much just saying that was one lifetime. Time started again and we're back through again. Like a record or a tape on spool. It's such a simple idea. But I can't think of anywhere else it's been done before. And it made Moira such an interesting character, I thought. Because there's that back in the day, back when it was Claremont and Cockrum and John Byrne, you think, well, why is Moira even involved with this lot?
Right.
Yeah. And there's no reason for her to be involved. Obviously, then Proteus comes along, but up to that point, there's no reason, right? So you're like, it was always a bit of a kind of like a non-sequitur, like what? Why is she there? But this book could go somewhere to explain that. Mystique and Destiny are in it. I think they are absolutely badass together. I'm looking forward to the clarification of their relationship that's allegedly coming up. The only thing wrong with this book, the dreaded 9-panel page returns, which I have got to say is overused to the max. I'm sick of seeing it. So, storytellers, artists, writers, stop plotting 9-panel pages. Stop it.
There you go. So I don't agree with you about the 9-panel page. Sometimes I think let me finish. Sometimes the 9-panel page is good for exposition purposes. If you need to kind of further along the plot and you don't have a lot of time to do it, a 9-panel page kind of gets that all out, and then that leaves you more room for the larger panel pages.
Totally. Okay, but this book's 38 pages long. If you can't get the dialogue and exposition out in 38 pages...
Are you kidding? Some of the pages are full-on text, man. Some of these 38 pages are just text.
All I'm saying is I have this year, I have suffered the 9-panel page on Batman.
Yeah.
Doomsday Clock, when it comes out every now and again.
Mr. Miracle.
Yeah. Heroes in Crisis.
Yeah.
This. It's like, I get it. Watchmen set the bar. I understand. But it shows maturity. This is the way adults like to read comics. We don't need splash panels. We don't need big muscly blokes and curvy women doing whatever it is they're doing. We need like talking heads. No, we don't. We do if you want it every now and again, but it's getting to the point where nearly every comic book has this storytelling method in there. All I'm saying is, let's change it up a little bit, please.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the overall idea of this book and the whole idea of Moira being this Omega level mutant with a power that we've never seen before. And before I crack on it, I think this is a stroke of genius. It's exactly what you said before, mm-hmm. because it allows Hickman to explore other timelines and realities, right? Mm-hmm. Without messing with his overall main story.
Yeah.
And it also kind of makes you think, especially when we talk about Powers of X in a minute, are these all the same timeline that we're talking about?
Yeah.
which made me think after I read this issue and then read Powers of X 2.
Timeline Prime. Yeah.
Yeah. So
we call it Power House of X, and yeah, but we know Lucas likes calling it House of Ten.
Yeah, early.
So is this where this 10 comes from in this?
Maybe it's 10 timelines?
Maybe.
Well, look at the back of House of X number 2, and they have all of Moira's lives with the timelines. Yeah. And, you know, count them up, because that might be 10, because there's several. But, so when you said you've never seen something like this done before, I remember this movie called Groundhog Day about 25 years ago with Bill Murray, where he woke up every Groundhog Day.
Yeah, fair enough. I meant in comic books, numbnuts.
No, I know. But so this is that's exactly the first thing that I was thinking of when I was like, oh, first life, second life, third life, fourth life. There is 10 lives, by the way. So maybe Lucas has got something there.
Maybe.
So, anyhow, I think that this was done brilliantly to show Moira's progress throughout the different lives that she's had, where, you know, the first life was just the normal life. You know, she didn't know she was a mutant. And then the second life, where she realized that she was, and then before she could meet Professor X, crashed and died. And then the third life, where she ended up meeting Xavier, and then are realizing mutants needed to be eradicated, and that's where you see Mystique and Destiny show up and kill her. But the thing that struck me as the most on this particular issue was the scene between Destiny and Moira, where Destiny is talking to her about, like, look, I know all about all of your lives, and I see them. Which, that's a level up for Destiny, like, big time, right? You know?
Definitely.
And from reading that, I was just like, wow, because now all of a sudden, Moira, this Omega-level mutant we didn't know about, has another... now Destiny seems like she might be an Omega-level on the other end, as far as being able to see absolutely everything in all possible timelines, right? And and realize that, you know, telling her... you know, I only see that you have 10 lives, maybe 11, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, okay. So now it's, you know, now you're limiting Moira from having an unlimited amount of chances to fix everything, right?
Yeah. Because it has to be like a level, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that also tells to me, especially, and to me, this is a big kind of foreshadowing thing. So when she says, I see 10 lives, Moira, maybe 11 if you make the right choice at the end. Mm-hmm. So now where this main storyline that we're reading now is Moira's 10th life, right?
Mm-hmm. That's what I think, yeah. This is her last chance,
and maybe at the end she makes her choice, and then after House of and Powers of X, this will be the 11th, right? Yeah. So that'll be the hard reboot.
Yeah,
is that kind of fair?
It's kind of how I say it, but of course, how often do we say these things and the complete opposite comes out? But you know.
Yeah, you know,
there's no one. Not to say that Destiny's telling the truth. She could have loads of lives, but Destiny's only telling her she's got this to try and keep her some level of control over her.
Right.
Yeah, because I mean, just because Darth Vader tells you he's dead doesn't mean it's true.
So I guess that's true. So tell me what you would. How do you feel about having this revelation of Apocalypse being more of like a leader of the X-Men in one of her lives?
Totally okay with it. I think Mori looks super hot next to Apocalypse. So
well, she's like Lady Apocalypse.
yeah, Lady. Yeah. It just shows you the depths of how she's trying to do the various different things. And it's not as if it's not the first time the X-Men have been kind of mentored by a bad guy. They had Magneto for a while. They've been through Age of Apocalypse already. How the House of M stuff. So it's not like it's a new thing. I just thought the book was so well done. I'm going to go out on a limb and tell you right now that this so far has been my favorite book of the entire year. House of X 2 is the best book this year for me.
Really?
Yeah, just because of its scope, just because of how well it's written. It looks great. The colors by Mighty Gresher are fantastic. The only thing that kind of annoys me about the House and Powers is the font for the text.
Right.
I find it a little bit off-putting when you've got, it seems like you've got like a really big bubble and like itty-bitty letters. And I'm like, whoa. You know, so it's kind of, I know it's like a style that people are trying, that Clayton Cowles is going for. I'm getting used to it, but it's not my preferred choice. But
right.
from a sense of length and depth of a story, this book, just this single issue by itself, best issue by far.
So this issue too is more a revelation of a roadmap. Right.
Yeah.
It's a roadmap of what's to come and Hickman's setting up of his X universe. Right. So to me, that was amazing. And if anybody likes to destroy their books, just pull out the last couple of pages where they have the Mara timeline of all 10 lives. And if you could just like read each little bump in the road there of because this, you know, and this is what makes me realize that this whole story is going to be about Mara and her different choices that she's made that has caused the fall of the mutants all along the way, right? So to me, it's the whole story is going to be about what wrong choice does she make this time, you know? And we'll see, and I'm super interested in seeing what happens because they've pretty much gone through everybody, like, Xavier and Magneto joined forces, and then they split up, and then they die, and then Mara joins Apocalypse, and blah, 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 and then she dies, you know. And then so they've got everything going on there, and I just think it's pretty ambitious. I think
I agree to kind of
change everything really that's come before. I haven't seen anybody try this hard to kind of set right the X universe since Claremont, because Claremont kind of got in his own way a lot because of what, 17 years of continuity, your shit would be messed up too. But this to me really kind of gives organization and guidance to to the X universe, really. And you know, the other thing that's amazing me about even the previous few issues is that this is very, very much a Professor X and Magneto centered story, and all of the other X characters are either invisible, not here, very, very limited screen time or panel time, you know, between, you know, yeah, you're gonna have Cyclops a little bit, Jean Grey hasn't appeared since the first issue. Wolverine's kind of sporadically in here, but more of a, kind of a talking head, really. There's no action other than, it's just almost like a guidebook. And hey, set it up. But you're absolutely right. This was my favorite book to read all year so far. I've read it. It's really telling when I read it and then go back and read it again.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, oh, wait, what did I miss? I missed something in here.
Yeah, there's bound to be something. But right. So this is a huge, huge flame on.
Yes.
Obviously. There is one other problem that this book has. in that it impacts powers, because you expect powers to be as good as this. And I don't think powers is quite as good as House.
I agree with you. So now, as House of X is kind of really setting up the backstory for Hickman's universe, Powers of X is actually kind of giving you more of the timeline of what's going on now and in the future. So X year 1, year 10, year 100, year 1000.
Yeah, it's like loads of different times, isn't it? It's the past, the present, the future just around the corner, and the future way down the line. So it's kind of, it's jumpy in places.
Right.
It doesn't have a protagonist you can get behind. So House 2, for example, you, 3 pages in, you totally feel in Moira. You understand her motivation. You understand why she's doing things.
Right.
And even when she makes choices like hanging out with Magneto or hanging out with Apocalypse, you understand why she's making those choices. In Powers 2, there's not a single character that fills that role. So it feels as like people are just going through their usual motions a little bit. And I've got to say that I'm not a huge Master Mother mold fan. As much as I love Sentinels, and I absolutely love the Sentinels from way back when Neil Adams drew them, I've never liked Master Mold. It gets too complicated. You've got Sentinels, you've got Master Mold, you've got Nimrod.
Right. Well, yeah, and Nimrod features in the future timeline and the far future timeline as well.
So you kind of like, it's not that it's complicated, I get it, but they're not my favorites. It's not kind of the thing. So we'll do, Powers, of course, is written by Jonathan Hickman. Art by R.B. Silver, with inks by Silver and Adriano Di Benedetto, and the colours again by Marty Grescia and Clayton Cowles. Wait, check me out. I am on stat line today.
You get to do all of them today.
Oh, am I doing them all? Yes. Practice. So Powers 2, I think, follows the same kind of trend. It's a slower issue, very much like House 2 was.
Yes.
But because of that, and because there's no real focal character, you get the snippets of the different timelines. It just feels a little less satisfying somehow. It's still a massive flame on, because the ambition of the whole idea of the story is fantastic. And it's done well, and the dialogue's well, and Cyclops kick ass. But for large parts, I'm kind of, do I care, do I not care? Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
I'm going to disagree with you on one part, where I do think there is one focal point of this book, and the focus is on Nimrod. Nimrod is the main character of this book. He's mentioned in year 10, and then in year 100 and 1000, he's prominent. So to me, I think that's important, right? Because, Nimrod and the Sentinels really kind of, that's the end game, right? That's the X-Men's end game. By year 1000, pretty much what they've shown is that Nimrod is, or Nimrod's world mind, is really the future. And, and the X-Men are either non-existent or on the run. So to me, This is gonna feature in the latter part of the story, but what they have, the Phalanx shows up at the end, and I don't know if you noticed that. And did you read all the text?
I had to work out who the Phalanx was. I was like, I recognized the name from I dropped out of comics around that time, so I had no real sort of understanding of who he was, so I had to read the bump this time to work out what's going on.
Yeah, well, and it's useful even if you are an X-Men fan and know who the Phalanx is, and even they go through the Magus and the Technarchs and the Warlock characters and and all that too. So it's basically Hickman's idea artificial intelligence and the growth of artificial intelligence, and how if you have one mind, or say let's like one processing power, I guess you would call it, mm-hmm. artificial intelligence, one machine, one mind. A hive mind is 10, and then intelligence is 110,000. And then he even leaves you with the examples like the Kree Supreme Intelligence has the processing power of 10,000 minds. And then you go into the Technarch, which would be Magisaur or Warlock, right? 10,000 minds. And then a world mind. And the world mind features heavily in this story, right? Where the world mind or the civilization that they're living on in year 1000 is actually a world mind, which is a... which they give that the Nimrod character is now that world, mm-hmm. and then the Phalanx, which is a million, which they introduce at the end of this story, which is probably the antagonist of the entire thing, I guess. So,
well, it sounds like one of the problems with powers is there's too many antagonists. Because you're jumping across the four different time zones. Each zone's got a bad guy, and fair enough. The spark of the bad guy in the past could end up being Nimrod in the future. But because you're taking it at different strides, you're like, oh my God. Because the Nimrod in the future, he is batshit crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's like a few processors short of a computer, if you know what I'm saying. but up to that point, he's like, oh, it's just weighty. And... Powers needs the moment where things start to coalesce, I guess, for it to like really hit the stride that a house has. And maybe this coming week's it, because this week should be a house week, but it's not. It's another powers week. So this week we're getting powers 3, and then the following week we're getting house 3.
Oh, that's interesting. No, I didn't know they were flipping.
So they flipped the schedule this week. So maybe that could be to sort of like give us an immediate continuation of where we are in powers, which would help the story coalesce a bit better, rather than having to sort of like jump from where we are now in powers to go back to house or vice versa. So I don't know, but we're kind of nitpicking a little bit, because through the scope of the story, the depth of the story, the ambition, it's a huge flame on. It's probably the most ambitious storyline that Marvel put together for a number of years.
Right, I agree with you.
And the fun thing is, because it's X only, it doesn't feel like an event book where it crosses over across the range.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's not like Fear itself. Where you've got Fear itself, and then you've got umpteen different tie-ins to it. This is very insular,
right? Yeah, well, not like War of the Realms from months ago.
So it feels that because it's so insular, it means you can, if you don't like X stuff, you can keep buying your Avengers and your Amazing Spider-Man and whatnot, and it doesn't impact you.
Right.
If you like buying X stuff, you don't have to buy Avengers or Spider-Man if that's not your cup of tea, because it's so structured in its place. I think that's how these type of things should always play out.
I think you're absolutely correct.
Too many times, important things happen in event storylines in books that you don't pick up, and then when you buy the actual, for the sake of argument, Fear itself. But if you buy the run like 1 through 6. Whatever happens between issues 1 and 2, because it happens in other people's books, if you're just buying the miniseries, you don't get the full story. At least with these X books, you're getting the whole thing because it's contained within these 12 issues. So I think whoever came up with the idea wants a big round of applause.
So the one last thing that I want to talk about House of X and Powers of X is the kind of bringing to center of Professor X and Magneto, who have been traditionally on polar opposite sides of the mutants, the good side, the bad side. And they explain very well in House of X 2, where Professor X becomes radicalized by what Moira shows him. And the same thing with Magneto, when they show Magneto, and that kind of brings them into that central common cause goal that now they're working together, and that to me is kind of amazing, and kind of, you know, they've been going on down this line with Professor X for a long time now too. Like, how good is he really? You know, how manipulative is he really? And we'll see that in Invaders too when we review that. But this, to me, bringing him more to center, and Magneto from more the, like, how evil he used to be, to kind of towards to like a middle ground, where Magneto has been and hasn't been, right? So this to me is it works naturally. It's I just think that it's the best way to do it, right? Because you can't have, now you have pretty much all mutants are allied, right?
Now,
no such thing as an evil mutant.
Exactly. You saw that in House One when Mystique and
Sabretooth
were doing their thing. The White Queen's hanging out with Magneto. So, you know, it's kind of, they're working towards a common goal, definitely. Does every mutant agree with Charles or Magneto? No, probably not. You're going to get the core characters like Scott and Jean, who are always going to agree with Xavier. You're going to have core characters like Mystique and Emma Frost, who might always agree with Magneto. But because the two figureheads have been pulled to the middle, as you say, then they can't help but be pulled into the middle as well.
Right.
And it was even telling when, in House One, Sabretooth calls Scott Slim, which is Wolverine's old nickname for him.
Well, that's a revelation. I didn't even think about that.
So that shows you how comfortable all the mutants are in relation to each other.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. That these books that I'm actually waiting for the next book. Usually I don't care, because usually it comes in when it comes in. But I'm just like, you know, and you even said, I think you were when we were talking to Al last week, and you were like, how come we didn't get the book?
I'm on the case all the way. It's like, why aren't we getting this straight away? Oh, well, because it's like, I don't care. We keep bigger secrets than bloody this.
Right. You
know? I read DC's Rebirth number 1 4 days before the spoilers hit out, and I didn't say jack about it. So,
I think we all read that together.
Yeah. So it's like,
We could keep secrets, Marvel, just to let you know.
Just to touch base on this, DC are also keeping secrets because they haven't closed that one off yet, and it's been so long now. I think people forget it's Rebirth. Anyway, bye. Next.
All right.
Powers are huge flame-ons.
Definitely. Yes. If you buy any Marvel book this year, make it House of X and Powers of X. But let's jump over to, let's do Invaders number 8. Invaders number 8. Can you believe it made it to an 8th issue? But
no, not at all.
All right, so this is the second part of a storyline. It's called Dead in the Water, and the I'm going to let Johnny say who this book is by.
Written by Chip Zdarsky. Zdarsky, yeah. Art by Carlos Magno and Butch Geis are on art.
Geese?
Geese has A's and S's in it, man.
Maybe.
Colors by Alex Guimarães and Donald Sanchez Amara. And VC's Travis Lanham. It's on letters. There you go.
All right. So anybody that loves the Invaders, these are the original, quote-unquote, original timely Marvel characters. Captain America, Namor, Human Torch. The Jim Hammond Human Torch, not Johnny, and Winter Soldier or Bucky. This book has been kind of a guilty pleasure for me, because I've always loved watching Namor kind of play the villain of the piece, and he's been the main villain of this book since issue one. And here in this book, you kind of get a kind of an inside look that things might not be as they seem. Where before you kind of like, okay, so Namor's back. He's against the surface world again. And now he's putting himself against Cap and against Human Torch. And even in the previous issues, which I'm sure you didn't read, Namor actually blew up the Human Torch because the Human Torch is an android. So, it doesn't mean death for him, which you see early on in this issue where Jim's head is now attached to an Iron Man body.
Yep.
Which... you know, hopefully that's going to be something that's rectified. But what amazes me is that he can flame on the Iron Man suit.
Yeah.
which is weird.
Yeah, I'm not even going there. I'm not even, not even touching that one.
Okay. So there's some other good characters in here. Toro, you remember him from All Winter Squad?
Yep.
But this book very much is a Namor book where they're actually trying to stop him. His plot was that he attacked a surface world city and sank it, and at that point also causing all of the residents of that city to become water breathers using a mutant that they reverse engineered into a formula to make all humans water breathers. So that makes the real villain of the piece, which would be Roxxon Oil. big companies. They're the villains. Because they want the technology, right? They always, yeah. That's what they want to run the world. And you see that in the very beginning of the book where they have the military saying, you know, hey, we want to do a tactical strike to take out Atlantis, but we're holding off because we want to see, how negotiations go. And then, Roxxon kind of stonewalls them and say, hey, you're not attacking until we get the stuff. Yeah. It's all about the technology and the money. Special interest and, lobbying. So they turn this into a kind of a political issue. But the real meat of the story comes when Winter Soldier meets Namor in a bar. And they have kind of a heart-to-heart where you realize that that Professor Xavier, who previously... In the last seven issues, you find out that when Namor was found on the docks back in Fantastic Four number four or five back in like the 60s, that he was actually mind wiped by Professor X, and that was kind of a bit of a retcon, right? But
Namor's the first mutant,
right? But Xavier actually put the ghost of one of Namor's friends that he had in World War II, kind of as a conscience. So this is kind of a bit of a retcon issue, right? And you realize that this guy, his buddy from World War II, has been in the back of his head for all this time, and he's really the one that's in control of Namor at this point.
Yeah,
The weird part about this issue, which may be a little confusing, is you see at some points in the back of this guy, in the back of Namor's head, is that his World War II buddy becomes Atlantean, right? He can become blue-skinned. Yeah. So you're not really sure, like, whether or not it's maybe Namor's Atlantean side that's really kind of winning out. But you do kind of find out towards the end of this book that really... Namor is got his work cut out from him because he is under possession of the Serpent Crown, which I think is a great plot device from back in the 70s. And I love the Serpent Crown. There was some, there's some great, great issues of Serpent Crown in the Avengers and in Namor. This is not the first time Namor's fallen under the Serpent Crown's power. There was a big crossover event in the 80s called Atlantis Attacks that had featured the Serpent Crown prominently.
It was going around kidnapping the women of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So, I think this ended up being like almost backwardly cool, right? Because at first, like the last seven issues, I was just thinking, oh, Namor's a dick again, which I was totally buying because Namor's frequently been a dick. But now we know that he's under possession of the Serpent Crown. And now, and then they bring back the Invisible Woman, which I think was a good spot, right?
Yeah, totally. to a point.
Yeah, and then you find out that Winter Soldier finds out about Namor's plan. Namor tells Winter Soldier, so now they realize that it's worse than they thought, and tune in next issue to find out how worse than we thought it actually is. I actually like this issue. I'm a big fan of Butch Geese's work.
Did you see his stuff on his independent book, Amber Black? Blake. Blake. I would say Black. I even write Black when I type it out. Yeah, but it's very, very similar to this. Really, really good, strong pencils.
Yes. He did Captain America for a while too, and he did Superman for a while too, right?
He did all sorts. He's
he was a layman in the industry for a long time.
Some people might see him as Jackson Geiss or Geese.
Right.
Juice. So just remember that it's the same bloke. One with his first name, one with his nickname, but it's the same guy. Definitely worth checking him out. It's funny because very much like Mike Diodata Jr. can trace like where he started going like house style to get a gig.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can see how his art has evolved across the years to something that now that he's doing his own style, it feels very much. His art gives this book a mature look that I'm not sure it really deserves.
Oh, okay.
It's because it's not the standard like Marvel art style. The book feels more mature somehow, visually. But when in places, it feels mature when you've got like the power play going on between Roxanne and the senator. But then when you've got the talky bit between Winter Soldier and Namor, that's just pure superhero bullshit. So I'm thinking, why does this art look so good for this book?
Well, that's that's one of the things I think I like about this book is it's kind of reminiscent about the art style on Ed Brubaker's Captain America run.
Yeah, which I can see that.
You know, and I forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think Butch might have drew a few issues of that too. But it primarily Steve Epting, and that's kind of like this art is reminiscent of a Steve Epting or.
It's a lot darker than Steve Epting. Steve Epting can draw quite house style. I've got some of his stuff on Avengers.
Right.
So if anybody picks up their own books this week from Marvel and they see there's a lack of words in their books, they need to check Invaders out because that's where all the exposition is, right in this book.
All the words are here. Yeah, this is definitely an old school Marvel book that takes you 20 minutes to read.
I'm not even sure that some of the words in this book deserve to be in this book. There's that many words. There's that many balloons. I'm like, what? I mean, I know VC do a lot of work for Marvel, but have you got them mixed up a little bit? All joking aside.
They charge by the letter.
Yeah, there's a lot of reading in this book. A lot of reading. I first came across the Invaders back in the late 70s. Over here, every Christmas, we get like these hardback books called annuals. And they're normally, I don't know, whatever. So he had a Fantastic Four one, and in this particular Fantastic Four story, the Thing had been sent back in time and was in World War II with the Invaders. I can't remember if he went there as Ben Grimm or if he went there as the Thing, but it was really quite odd. And I was like, that was the first time I'd heard about the Invaders, because, you know, it's not really a British thing. You know, American heroes go to fight the war. So, okay. And I've always been kind of intrigued by it. I'm not sure because the war that they actually fight on this is a facsimile war created by Roxxon and government, that Invaders is the right title for it. I get it because it's to use the characters and stuff, but it doesn't feel like they're actually fighting for something like the original group did. So I think it's a beat out of time, very much like Captain America himself could be, which leads me to the next issue. Which Captain America is this? Is this the Captain America before he was in Avengers recently? Or is this the Captain America where he's left his old uniform and is now Steve Rogers? And the same could be said for Sue Richards. Is this the Sue Richards that is back with her husband as they came back? Or is this Sue Richards that's now doing her own thing in her own miniseries? The C word is my problem with this book. Before anyone goes nuts and says I'm swearing, I am. Continuity. You didn't know how I was going to say that, but that's the word I'm saying. Continuity.
Dirty word today in Marvel Comics.
It is like, where is this book?
Well, they also have Black Panther in here too, who is out in space. So.
And it's like, I get it. It's like sometimes, and this isn't just a Marvel thing, so I'm not having to go at Marvel for this. It feels sometimes like comic book creators have a good idea for a story, and then no matter by hook or by crook, they're going to tell that story no matter what, regardless of what that does to the other books.
So,
if anything at all. And that's the problem. There's no ramification. I kind of think to myself, if this was in continuity with Captain America book, there's no way Captain America's doing or allowed to do some of the stuff he does now, or vice versa.
Well, so I would say the and probably Marvel would say too, the argument against continuity in books these days is because when you go to the bookstore and pick up a trade paperback, no one gives a shit whether or not Captain America is running from the law or Black Panther is out in space.
That's unless you buy the relevant trade paperback itself.
Correct.
If you, correct. All right, fair enough. It doesn't have to tie into the comic, but it's like, okay, I could go to the store today, buy a Captain America trade and buy this in trade, the two don't match. So
right.
it's kind of like, okay, here's a metaphor for you. I was watching some of the X-Men cartoon, you know, the X-Men animated series?
Yes.
Right, so I've got a couple of DVDs, and when you watch them, and they're not the main titles, not like the Dark Phoenix saga, they're just like a collection of episodes. There's one episode where everything's going along great. Everything's fine. Next minute, without any reason, Xavier's walking around with Magneto stuck in the Savage Land. No explanation of why they got there. And obviously, they've missed some episodes and then just put these certain episodes that they wanted to on the DVD collection. It's not the full series. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah.
So you're kind of like, that's what happens when you pick up trade paperbacks and they don't have any sort of link. And I know you mentioned Groundhog Day. Invaders, using a mutant gene to turn people into water breathers before they die. I'm sure I've seen that in an X-Men movie. Sure I've seen that.
All right.
So, touche, my friend, touche. So this book for me is a Mr. Fantastic. I'm kind of interested. I'm kind of not. Giving an Invisible Woman would be a little bit of an insult because I do like Butch Geist. So I'm going with that. Mr. Fantastic.
And I'm going to flame on the book because I really liked it. And I like where they're going and where they've been. It's captured my interest. So I want to see what happens.
It's old school. You like old school.
I really, really do. I really do.
It's like an old school.
Well,
good, like the old school.
From old school to new school, let's go to The Amazing Spider-Man number. What number is this? 27?
27.
Or in the legacy number, it's 828.
Whoa.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. What can I imagine what? It's still 172 issues behind Detective Comics in Action, if not. So, you know. So don't get all like, ooh, that's a big number. It's not.
So someone that was a kind of not even a fringe comic book fan, but we were talking about comics yesterday, and he says, wow, he says, answer me a question. How can sitcoms and TV shows last for like maximum 10 years and you get like a book like Spider-Man? How can they be publishing Spider-Man like 60 years after he debuted? And I was like, I don't know. How can the Avengers make $1 billion at the box office? I never thought that it would do that. You know?
Mm.
But to me, you know, there have been a comic book fans, and, you know, 50, 60 years ago, it was a lot more affordable. And that's all people were doing, because a lot of people didn't have TVs and didn't have movies at their fingertips or what have you. So, mm-hmm. I mean, but it is definitely a dying industry, for sure. But anyhow, let's review Amazing Spider-Man number 27.
Totally rained on the parade there, didn't you? Oh.
I did.
It's been a dying industry for years.
It has been. And I didn't mean to kind of shit on it. But.
Yeah, you're right.
All right.
So. I hope your copy of House of X2 has a big, massive crease in it. There you go.
Oh, no. The digital crease.
You don't buy new stuff anymore. Oh, see?
I don't. I know. Can I tell you the last time I actually bought an actual copy that I could hold in my hands of any comic book?
Was Jimmy Carter still in prison?
No, it was pre-divorce, Professor, which was over 10 years ago. I had budgetary constraints, and I could not buy comics for a long time. So, and then when I got back into it, it was digital was just the way to go because I didn't have space. So, you know.
Okay, I'll let you off.
Boo! All right. So, go ahead with Amazing Spider-Man. Go ahead.
Nick Spencer is on writing chores. Art by Kev Walker, ink by John Dell, which I found quite ironic. John Dell inks, you know. What do you use a printer for that? I don't know. Colors, Laura Martin, and letters by VCs, Joe Caramagna.
He's a busy guy.
That's VCs, massive. It's huge. Yeah. So I picked this on a glance. I looked at it, thought, oh my God, this is just too much noise. I'm going to pick it just so I can go, there's too much noise. But then this morning, I actually took the time to read the damn thing. And whilst the glance says, the book is chaotic, there's too many characters, there's too many arms, not enough buddy girls, no fishnets. I was prepared to clobber the whole thing. But when I read it, yes, it's chaotic. Yes, there's too many arms. Yes, there's not enough buddy girls. And yes, there is definitely no fishnets. You know what? It also has a really daft sense of fun. And when I think back to, because I read this after I read Invaders. So here's my reading so far for the show. I read House, I read Powers, I read Invaders, then I read this. This was the sort of mindless kind of lemon sorbet type story that you need just to get all that heaviness out of the way and remember why you like comics in the first place. It's Spider-Man doing what Spider-Man does. You know, he cracks a joke, he turns up, does some webbing, Spider-Sense gets him into some trouble. Yeah, there's a little bit of, which I found absolutely hugely ironic. There's a bit where the girls are telling off Boomerang for mansplaining something to them. And when they're in the cave talking to each other, they're actually mansplaining to the reader. So it's like, dudes, what you doing? You've just dissed one guy for doing it, and you're doing the exact same thing.
It's so tongue in cheek. Yeah,
it's no, I know. But and I was kind of on the fence. I was like, do I need to be preached at? Do I need to patronize that? And then it got me thinking. Well, actually, hold on a second. Spider-Man Like Avengers is probably Marvel's most cross diverse readership book. Would you agree?
Because
you get old school fans like us who like Spider-Man and Avengers from back when we were kids and stuff. And then, of course, because they're so multinational with all the movies and stuff, you're going to get a lot of extra fans reading it. So you know what? Some of this stuff isn't aimed at me. Some of it is aimed at people who might know better or need to be educated on certain things. And I don't have a problem with that when I thought of it like that. So I was kind of like, yeah, okay, fair enough. It's the price you have to pay for Spider-Man making $1 billion or Avengers making $1 billion.
Right.
The fact is that, you know, sometimes those books aren't going to be written purely with us older readers in mind. Unlike House of X and Powers, which is purely aimed at us start to finish, no ifs, no buts. The dialogue I thought was snappy. I thought the action scenes were great. The art, I thought it was just good enough. Some of the panels reminded me of the Ultimate Spider-Man cartoon, that some really good like action shots, but then when he loses that dynamism and he becomes more solid on foot on ground, or he's stood up or whatever, he loses something.
Right.
And the panel and the posture changes a little bit. And you know my Spider-Man has to be all elbows and knees. You know, that's his thing. I've said it like a gazillion times.
Yeah, and no one listens to you. I don't know why that is.
They listened on an Endgame when I called the Ed, so I don't care about that so much. What I did like was the expressions on the faces were done fantastically well. I liked them all. I loved Boomerang's stupid grin when he doesn't understand how much trouble he's actually in.
Yes.
It's just like totally ignorant to the whole danger. He's just like blah, 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 doing his own thing. So, so funny. So all in all, I was prepared to clobber this. I'm afraid it's a big fat flame on.
Oh, there awesome.
There you go. Three flame on out of four.
This is amazing. We'll kill that streak. All right. So I love this book too. And you know, this book, Nick Spencer's muse is obviously Boomerang. He did it in, was it Deadly Foes of Spider-Man when he was doing that? Or it was Superior Foes of Spider-Man. That was his claim to fame so far. It was Nick Spencer writes the best villains when he can just go full on and just write villains all the time, because they're funny and they laugh at themselves. And Boomerang especially is that like very unaware of his own place and everything. And to me, it's just amazing. And nothing says amazing more than when he realizes all the women villains don't like him, and he's like, hey, what did I ever do to you? And then they had three exact panels of, hey, nice costume. You know, and I just thought that was totally hilarious, because it really is just he's clueless, and that's what makes him funny. And and then of course his joy when Spider-Man pops up and all the villains are like, Spider-Man, and he's like, Spider-Man. Like, yay, we're having a team up. I just thought that actually made me laugh out loud. And and the, you know, when how they beat Spider-Man so quickly and just kind of funnily. So this book, it really is just brainless fun, you know, from beginning to end.
I liked Aunt May when she was telling Spider-Man. I take it nobody knows. She doesn't know now. It's got wiped.
Right.
Right. Okay. Right. So I liked it when Spider-Man, you've got to go and help him. My nephew is rather fond of him.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, he isn't really at all. You totally got the wrong end of the stick, but still.
Yeah, that was good stuff.
It just screamed old school. I still wish they'd do more with Mary Jane.
Yeah, but, so that's the thing, is they kind of really get away from other plot lines, right? I mean, the what's the villain's name? The Kindred or something? Yeah. That new guy that's been running around since issue one. He doesn't appear anywhere in this issue, and he's kind of been lurking around. And the last couple of issues, they kind of brought him to the forefront and kind of made him more of an impending threat. And then he's gone this issue. That's the one would be one of the gripes that I would have. And of course, no Mary Jane, who I guess they've been kind of they've been kind of playing up the last few months too, that she's going to have a bigger role in this book going forward. But this really is kind of a mindless fight issue with the sinister syndicate, which, you know, Boomerang was mad that they stole the name.
It's just Syndicate now.
the Syndicate?
Yeah, it's what it is now. Yeah. So, yeah, I thought this book was just, you know, it was just so, as you say, it was so fun. Even getting away from all the dark Spider-Man stuff with the Kraven story not so long ago, it felt back to basics, which I think was the kind of, was that not the kind of the hook for this book in the first place?
Yes.
Yeah.
So. Yes. Hey, what would you think if Nick Spencer did a Boomerang limited series? What would you buy it? Would you get it?
I would definitely read it. My problem with characters like Boomerang is that they can be a one-trick pony, and once you've done stupid buffoonery once, going over it again, sometimes it gets a bit samey. Yes. Look at people like Booster Gold, for example.
Oh, okay, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Buffoon. He's a buffoon.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all well and good when he reacts with someone like straight up like Batman. Sorry, I know I'm using DC characters, but it's the one that kind of sprung to my mind. But it's okay when he's doing it with Batman, but when he does it with Superman, you're like, yeah, I've seen this already. It works better. So you've kind of got to use it sparingly, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he might be able to hold a limited series together, especially if you threw in, Shocker or something like
that. Pisspot Pete. Let's have some Pisspot Pete in there.
You know, how many cheesy villains can they, you know, have them run around with Hypno Hustler or something? That would be just comedy for days.
Rocket Racer.
Yeah. You know, there definitely is no bottom to the cheesy Spider-Man D-listing villains. So,
and what do you mean nobody listens? Are you saying you disagree with the fact that Spider-Man should be all elbows and knees?
I absolutely agree with you about elbows and knees.
Okay. Fine.
Okay. All right. So this is a flame on for me too. So I loved Amazing Spider-Man, and I'm a pretty big Nick Spencer fan for Spider-Man. So, you know, he can do whatever now.
I'm just waiting for the Hail Hydra moment. There's got to be one.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, when Mary Jane puts on the spider costume, that's probably when they jump off. But we'll see. All right, when Aunt May teams up with Galactus. Was that a Hostess Cupcake ad or something like that?
Oh, something like that. Like that. Oh, when she starts dating Doctor Strange.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Peter, my new boyfriend is magic with his hands.
She likes the doctors, that's for sure. All right, so let's.
We have time for one more, don't we?
We do. We're going to do okay. So this is called Absolute Carnage, Separation Anxiety, and we're talking about this because of the Absolute Carnage, event. That is happening across the Spider books starting this month. And this is probably one of the several satellite books that have come out so far. And this is going to be written by Clay McLeod Chapman. Oh, wait, you're going to do it. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, fine. I could have said, you picked the ones I can say. Brian Level, Jordan Boyd, and Travis Lanham. All right, so artist, colorist, and letterer, respectively. So you take away the ones I can say. Fine. Go on, carry on.
So, to give you a bit of a background, you know, back in the early 90s when Venom was, you know, best thing since sliced bread, he was actually more of a, like a, like a Deadpool. Like, he was all over the place, right? He was, Venom was in everything. In one of the limited series, they introduced the offspring of Venom, which were the, there were five of them: Scream, Lasher, Riot, Agony, and Phage. And apparently, in a previous appearance, I imagine it was an issue of Deadpool, that all of those five symbiotes were attached to a dog. And this issue shows the dog, actually, the symbiotes split, and they all chase and take over a wonderful family of four. And it's done in, I imagine, what's supposed to be kind of like a horror movie feel. Like, I kind of think that we're supposed to be very fearful, and we're supposed to feel really bad for this fighting family that that gets taken over, and then they spend the rest of the issue, the kid taking over the kids. And I don't really know how much I can say about this book. It definitely was not for me. I think it was the art. I think they try to make you to try to do like a horror type thing with the fear on the kids' faces, and the symbiotes look very mutant-y, blobby tentacles, and just try to take you over. There's a couple of really kind of disturbing visuals of, they kill the neighbor, and then he's laying on the table serving him up like they're going to eat him. There's a prolonged scene where they're trying to get the little girl to eat the guy on the table. It was just, it wasn't good. I didn't like it. It wasn't aimed at me. If something that has like supposed to be like a massive crossover, if I have something that's kind of really more of an adult nature with some disturbing visual images and everything, I don't know what Marvel was going for.
So I agree 110% with you on this one. I've been through what that little girl's gone through when families break up. It's not a fun time. And then on top of that, you traumatize it by being hunted down by what the Venom symbiont. What gets me the most is that Venom was supposed to be like the most powerful character at the time.
Yes.
And he was separated and whatevered by this corporation that had a hit on for Spider-Man. Now, if the corporation could do that to the Venom suit, you've got to question why they didn't just kill Spider-Man, because Venom kicks Spider-Man out of the place every time. So it's like, this is some crazy Marvel logic, but that's by the by. This book is disturbing. It's emotive for all the wrong reasons. The horror feel, I think they're trying to copy a little bit of Immortal Hulk.
Yes, yes.
In style, but I think the colours are disappointing. They don't have the same sort of resonance. It's a darker colour, so they're going for that really horror vibe.
Did it feel like an indie book for you? It kind of felt like an indie book for me.
Yeah, and I like indie books, but I don't. This book is just tasteless on so many levels. Some of it's my own personal issues from when my parents got split up. Some of it is the fact that they are practically forcing a kid to do stuff she doesn't want to do, including eat a person. I just think whoever signed off on this as an idea must have been smoking something particularly strong, because I have, as good as House of X is, and I've said early on that that was the best book of the year across the board, not just the best book, Marvel book, across the board, it's the best book I've read this year from the big two. This is the worst thing that I have looked at across every company, across all the Marvel books, the DC books, the indie books, whatever. This book was, it was ugly to read. It was ugly to look at. I can't even, I want to clobber it to the point where Galactus comes and sticks his machine in and eats it up. And even that, the book would make him barf. It's that bad. So
right.
I just find it absolutely distasteful across so many different ways. I cannot believe. I get the carnage is a big thing and everyone wants to do it. And if it's going to have an impact on Spider-Man, yeah, fine. But don't try and do something like this with it. Especially if you're going to try and carry that horror vibe over into a Spider-Man book. Because we've just said that Spider-Man isn't for just the adults of the comic book world.
Right.
Spider-Man is for everybody who reads comics.
So this book, and I can't agree with you more. This book, to me, had the opposite effect of what Marvel should be hoping for with these satellite books. This book in no way, shape, or form makes me want to read any of the Absolute Carnage series at all. It Absolutely. Makes me want to run the other way and just tell me when it's over so I can look.
To be fair, if we do, we're probably going to have to talk about Absolute Carnage at some point.
Right.
But I am really not looking forward to it. This book has absolutely just poured vinegar on what for me was an already dodgy idea. So that may mean I'm biased. I don't care. But for me, this book is a huge, you know, if I'm in a comic book shop and I see mums and dads with the kids and say, oh, can we buy this? Because it's got that. And I'll be like, dude, do not buy that book for that kid at all.
Yep.
And that, so, you know, it's distasteful to say the least.
Yeah. And that's what I think. If this is like the top of the iceberg for these Absolute Carnage books, because there's a lot of them coming out over the next few months. Wow. It's if this is any indication of what the rest of them are like, I think, you know, Marvel might actually have a bit of a media problem on their hands. If this book finds its way into some complaining parents.
Well, to be fair, I mean, a comic book company has to create books for its entire audience.
I agree with you there.
Yeah, because, you know, you get the whole range, like the Black Label books from DC at the moment, or Vertigo, or all that sort of stuff. But if you're going to do something like that, don't use a spider character. Do something that you know full well it's going to appeal to the mature reader, because that's what this book's aimed at.
So, this book is rated T+. It's, I mean, this really should be aimed at mature readers, am I right?
Agreed, totally. But hey ho. at least we have more X coming, so that's all right.
That is a good thing. All right, so that's gonna do it for this episode of No Prize Podcast. We will be back with you. Oh my god, well, we're gonna be back with you first weekend of September. That's wow. This year is going by very, very quickly.
That is the week before my vacay. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. The next time we're gonna be doing this, it's gonna be football season.
It's already football season.
Well, you know, American football season.
Preseason counts?
Preseason. Oh, yeah, the Patriots are on tonight.
Hey, Dolphins lost last night. Hey.
All right.
Atlanta, though. Isn't it wild that Atlanta have lost something like 13 straight preseason games?
Ah, really?
Yeah, check it out. What a bonkers stat.
they just picked up our cast off quarterback that we cut. Danny Etling. They just picked up Danny Etling.
Well, they're not getting rid of what's his name. So
I don't know. They can't do any worse, I think.
I don't know. The Falcons quarterback's decent. Is it Matt Ryan? I think, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Matt Ryan. So yeah, he's decent.
Yeah, he's not bringing the Falcons anywhere.
Well, you could say that about the dude at the Bengals, but you know. Or Kirk Cousins for Minnesota, but you know, there's a sure lack of quality play callers. Anyway, we digress.
Tune in next week for some more football talk. All right. So enjoy. We'll see you again in a couple of weeks. Have a good week.
Adios.